So the floor is open now for direct responses to this, whether it's Kantian or political or contemporary or historical, anything. The floor is yours. Just please introduce yourself so that we know where you're coming from, literally or metaphorically. Yes.
Dave Rasmussen. I got this argument. I want to hear what you say to this argument. It reminds me very much of the kind of argument that David Held was making a few years ago, and probably is still making. Namely that, and you said this early on, that the European Union provides a new form of constitutional representation. But it too is flawed, and I wonder how you deal with that, because it was not able to actually develop a constitution or to affirm a constitution, and we currently have a crisis in Europe.
This is a very important question, and it applies to Held as it applies to a number of people who are looking at the European construct and trying to make sense of what's going on there. I think that the major problem, and what everybody should be thinking about, but for some weird reason nobody is theories of representation. Why we don't have an accurate conception of representation at the supranational level? Look at the way the European Union has been developing ever since the 1970s. The account has been, the European Union starts as a very small enterprise committed to coal and, you know, a union of coal and steel. Then it becomes a more generalized market. And then all of a sudden it starts doing all sorts of things, which is why it needs to legitimize itself. So then it incorporates things such as human rights. There is a wonderful book written by somebody in the 1990s called Human Rights in the European Union, A Study in Irony. Now, they didn't care about it. All they needed was just to legitimize their actions. But of course, hypocrisy is a wonderful thing. And, you know, when, you know, hang on to that and then draw on it. And eventually human rights become central to the European enterprise and the union keeps growing and growing. As the union keeps growing and growing, you need to legitimize the decision-making process at the supranational level. And what has been the major assumption that the Europeans everywhere have made is that the way you obtain democratic legitimacy at the national level is the way you're going to get it to the supranational level. So that you have a legitimacy problem, well, make the elections for the European Parliament direct elections, not indirect elections. You have a problem with legitimacy, give the European Parliament more powers, which is exactly what's been happening. 1979, the first direct elections for the European Parliament, the powers of the European Parliament increased continuously to the point where under the Treaty of Lisbon, the Parliament is really, you know, like the House of Representatives. You know, it is really a chamber just like the Council, a legislative chamber just like the Council. What has been the, you know, have the people of Europe found themselves in the European Union because of this? Of course not. The participation rate for the European Parliament have been dropping from about 60% in the late 1970s to about 30-40% now, which is bad. But let me tell you, they're very low in Eastern Europe. You would have thought that of all Europe, it would be Eastern Europe, the place where everybody would go out to vote. I went to vote for the elections of the European Parliament because I had nothing to do that day. And there were the Romanians at the electoral booth. You know, there was nobody there. There were just the three people in the electoral commission. Good thing they had a bottle of wine. And I spent the entire day there with them. Nobody showed up. When there's elections for the president of Romania, for parliament, all the Romanian students who study at MIT, Harvard, BC, go and vote. Nobody cares. These have the status of low rank. European elections have, elections for the European Parliament have the status of low ranking local elections. So it hasn't worked. This process of legitimation has not worked. The powers of the European Parliament have been going up, becoming greater. But again, have you heard much mention of the European Parliament in the recent crisis in Europe? Not really. So the process for legitimizing decisions at the European level which has been a mirroring of how decisions are made and legitimized at the national level, has failed. The real question for all of us should be, how can you have self-government? What are the mechanisms for representation at the supranational level? And I mean, that's a very Kantian question, but it's the right kind of Kantian question, because it gives you enormous, it forces you to ask the right question, but it gives you freedom with respect to the institutional structure for answering it. We should impose a moratorium on all European scholarship so that nobody could publish anything in the next 5 years if it's not an answer to this question. that's my view of the solution. Speaking of democracy.
Yes, Alan.
From your talk, it sounds like you've got nationalism on one end and cosmopolitanism at the other, but nationalism is cosmopolitan with respect to sectionalism, and sectionalism is a big phenomenon now. So I wonder, could sectionalism actually contribute to cosmopolitanism by bypassing nationalism? Or is sectionalism so antithetical to cosmopolitanism that it would be antithetical to your objective?
No, precisely because of this, I did not entitle the session in the section in the paper "The Critique from Nationalism." I call it "The Critique from Democracy." Kant thought that nationalism is a cosmopolitan duty. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason why to us the whole tension between cosmopolitanism and nationalism comes is that we no longer have, you know, it's because of what happened in the 19th century, it's because we no longer have, you know, that conception of nationalism where, you know, it doesn't come into tension with, and there is. I was about to say interesting work. There is work on, you know, rooted cosmopolitanism. People like Bruce Ackerman have written on that, Anthony Appiah. There's an interesting work that's been done on that. What I'm saying here does not challenge it. If you take for granted the existence of states, and if you take for granted the plurality of legal jurisdictions, which is a project on cosmopolitanism in constitutional law must do. There might be a criticism. There's nothing about cosmopolitanism in what I'm saying. But to the extent that you take constitutional jurisdictions, the plurality of constitutional systems for granted, then you cannot have. Then you need to find a way of connecting context, particularized context, particular constitutional, legal, constitutional culture, political culture, with a broader project. So in that sense, you know, I think that if anything, this is the kind of claim that forces us to recover some of the insight behind the view that cosmopolitanism is that nationalism is a cosmopolitan duty.
Yes?
I'm Frank Garcia. But where in your vision of sort of cosmopolitan globalization, cosmopolitan constitutionalism or constitutional democracy, where do you see a place for the decent hierarchical states? Do you see them as necessarily always outliers, or is there a role in your vision of constitutionalism, global constitution, mm-hmm. for a constitutionally hierarchical state?
Thank you for asking me about Viktor Orban. let me give an answer and stop me if I'm going in the wrong direction with the hierarchical state, with what I think you mean by the hierarchical state.
I mean Rawls is sort of saying there's got to be room within our system for a decent hierarchical state. We have to have room for some sort of relationship with that.
A non-liberal sort of constitutional but non-liberal,
yes.
Something like that. Yes.
Yeah, a constitutional but non-liberal. It's an interpretative question when it comes to Kant, whether, you know, about the universal vocation, the fact that, you know, this is a model that applies to all states, you know, how can they be, do they have to be liberal, do they have to be decent but not liberal, where on the scale can they be? I will say that I share less and less the sensibilities of late Rawls. I started by sharing more, by very much buying into the sensibilities of political liberalism, of identifying political philosophies and constructs that, you know, can be reached from a diversity of standpoints. But what happens to me is that the opposite happens to me as I get older, is what happened to Rawls. I believe with Amartya Sen, in a way, I believe that we should not... I believe that the comprehensive conception of liberalism is sufficiently broad and welcoming to allow for a sufficient variety of institutional structure that would accommodate everything we call decent. Now that's a controversial thing to say, but I stand by this. I mean, I think that, and it might have something to do with how I think about liberalism in general, you know, whether I see it connected to a particular conception of the good. But there is...
Did I add a caveat to that? But then doesn't, you know, you had a lot of things to say at the beginning characterizing cosmopolitanism, but doesn't that put you in the context of the typical criticism of cosmopolitanism, which is to say it doesn't account for pluralism? It is a comprehensive doctrine. You just said that you're willing to, you know, accept. And that, it seems to me, is the really significant critique of cosmopolitanism. Yeah.
Well, you see this quite often made in the European context, where pluralism is not understood as a pluralism as conceptions of the good, but really a pluralism of sources of constitutional authority. So if you look in the development of the European Union, what you're going to see is a shift from a hierarchical conception to a network conception, where there is a claim to constitutional authority that is made from different centers, and then they have to negotiate the way that, you know, they accommodate their competing claims. And the argument all along has been that, well, the way you accommodate them is an ethic of constitutional tolerance, of constitutional accommodation, of constitutional pluralism. Where we all appear to be pluralist in the European context, and there is a connection between that kind of pluralism and cosmopolitanism. And people like Alex Stone Sweet make that connection. Now, I have to admit that I have never been quite convinced by the argument about constitutional pluralism in the European context. I think constitutional pluralism is an infant disease of European legal thought. And I think we're going to get over it at some point. We might not get over it soon, and the patient might die before we get over it. But if we are to do the counterfactual history of the future of the European Union, I think that this whole excitement about constitutional pluralism will fade at some point, because I if anything, it's a stage thing. The one important thing that the scholarship on constitutional pluralism has given us is that it has expanded legal thought in the following way. Traditionally, under a Kelsian top-down hierarchical conception of a legal system, you cannot have of course you have conflicting claims of authority, but they can be solved from the perspective of the systems, you know. So the mafia in southern Italy makes a claim to authority in a way that that is competing to the claim of authority made by the Italian state, and the Italian state will crush it, or the mafia will crush it. The conflict will be solved one way or another. The most interesting part about scholarship on constitutional pluralism in the European Union is that it basically tells you that the conflict does not have to be solved one way or the other, and that a legal theory can be sound without the attempt to solve the conflict. So the conflict becomes internalized within a jurisprudential account, and it stays that way. It might be solved. Law doesn't run out. Legal thought can still conceptualize conflict of that nature. So I think that for this particular reason, thinking about constitutional pluralism has been helpful in European law. But I see the problems with this pluralistic conception of constitutional authority, the same as the problems, going back to your question out there, the same with the problems with the pluralistic conception of conceptions of the good, which is the fact that it is a descriptive account that does not put the intellectual energy where it should be, which is the engagement of the different centers of authority. So we have come to treat claims about the plurality of conceptions of the good the same way that judges in Europe treat claims about the plurality of conceptions of authority, which is by way of structural deference. Oh, that's what you think? You know, that's your view of the world? Okay, I defer to it. And I have this account that allows me to defer to it, that forces me to defer to it. I think that's a travesty of how institutions should work. In political institutions are the only thing we have, the way why they have this, you know, civilizing effect, so to speak, is that they force people to engage in a way that otherwise they would never engage. And to say that that's my conception of the good, it's the beginning of the conversation, is not the end of it. And if you look in European law, the claim about constitutional pluralism has basically tended to be the end of the conversation rather than the beginning of it. Let me give you an example, which will be juicy and you'll like it. A games company, laser tag, from the United Kingdom is trying to open the franchise in Germany that is trying to import laser tag from the United Kingdom. Kids running around, you know, playing laser tag. In Germany, the authorities in, I think, Bonn, ban laser tag on the ground that it is a violation of human dignity. That allowing kids to play, shoot, they're shooting each other, violates the German conception of human dignity. It's a funny thing, you know, in Romania, this would be a school trip. You know, there would be nothing more exciting than it. In Germany, it violates human dignity. So then the issue goes before the European Court of Justice that looks at it. Okay, so this is allowed in Great Britain. It presumably doesn't violate human dignity in Great Britain. This is banned in Germany because we're told it violates human dignity. You know? And then he says, okay, then we defer to the Germans. Because, you see, we have a pluralistic conception of ideas of human dignity. And if you say it violates your conception, fine. What you need is engagement. What you need is the judge to be there and say, well, in what sense does it violate? What exactly does it violate about human dignity? Tell us more. Instead, what you have is structural difference. The reason why there has not been a common European identity after 50 years of this wonderful experiment is precisely because the legal system, law is typically seen as really at the forefront of European integration. That's the wrong way to think about it. It's really because law has not reached out to all the different corners of political action, of political self-understanding, and forced people to do that which only law can do, which is force them to reflect, enhance reflection about the social practices in which they're engaged. Unless that changes, and I don't see how it will change. I'm Eastern European, I don't do uplifting. So this will not change. I see no way in which this can change. But unless this changes, the project doesn't have much of a future. I mean, it does, but not an interesting one.
Yeah, Jonathan.
I'm kind of interested by that last comment that law, you know, can produce or enhance reflection, partly in light of thinking about Kant. I'm interested to know whether you think that's something that Kant thought. I mean, as opposed to providing for a kind of supportive environment for reflection, and I'm thinking about the conceptual reasons why he came to think that he didn't want to support what he called a world government, and it was because he thought of sovereignty in a way that required him to either locate it at the national level, you know, with the side-by-side territories, or at the global level. It was because sovereignty was tied for him to the idea of people.
Mm-hmm.
And either there were peoples side-by-side, or there was one people at the level of the globe. But it's interesting to think about some of these issues in the EU in light of that, because then he talks about the separation of powers, and he doesn't resolve a problem that I just read this interesting article by Jack Goldsmith and Darrell Levinson talking about some of the structural similarities in international law and constitutional law with respect to certain kinds of problems involved in the absence of third-party enforcement, for instance. So when there are these constitutional conflicts between, say, the different branches of government, there's no third party to enforce the resolution.
Mm-hmm.
If the court says something, why do the other branches follow it? You know, the court doesn't have an army, and so on. So, but Kant doesn't say anything about how these things, he just says they have equal dignity. And then he defines sovereignty by way of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, if you think about that, because that problem wouldn't be solved even if there was a world government. And presumably that has something to do with the way that law can produce reflection, in the sense that you get legal disputes not just between subjects or citizens who are subject to like ordinary statutes and then have to go to the courts, right? But then you get the disputes about the constitutional norms. So I just want to,
mm-hmm.
Do you think Kant thought that law, because in his process he seemed to say, you know, war and commerce or something
mm-hmm.
like that are going to drive us towards a global legal order. Religion and culture are going to prevent it from being a world government. And law seems to be more like a means for just peaceful coexistence. But you seem to think it has a more productive...
Yeah, I mean, I think that something like cosmopolitan right would... There's more to it than this. But we'll have to talk more about it. One reason that he gives and why he's so, he puzzles so many on the question of why he didn't think that the world republic or an international state was the right, you know, was why he didn't support that, was that he thought that it was impractical, that it wouldn't happen, which is very un-Kantian to care about the practicalities of things, and then of course he has the idea that, you know, that kind of, imagine if that kind of power was to be abused. So we'll have to talk more about, you know, the connection to self-government and sovereignty. I don't think he's a John Austin. I don't think he is somebody who thinks that the second sovereignty becomes any less than absolute is no longer sovereignty. Presumably the idea, he didn't choose to theorize a coercive federation of states. But a coercive federation of states is not a contradiction within Kantian thought. So you can think about it. So even sovereignty that's put under pressure is, you know, still remains sovereign.
If it's quick, we have a minute.
Somebody else wants to jump in.
Well, I had a 30-second question. Do you have it, Alan? Do you have it?
I think Diane has a question in the back.
What's that?
So it was the Cosmopolitan, obviously part of your title, me down from another campus. So I was thinking at the very beginning is when you sort of described cosmopolitanism, sort of or its problems. And thinking about how it wove into the discussion today. And do you see it as surviving as a weaker form? And I don't mean that in a sort of negative way, but just simply sort of an objective, you know, a weaker version than what might otherwise its goals, its claims, its aspirations?
That's a subversive question.
That's an
appropriately subversive question. I struggle with this because I struggle, I have a love-hate relation with the state. In an argument of this nature, it's clearly a weaker version. It's a conception that makes compromises if you think of the conception as capable of being something more than this. But the compromises are, the apparent compromises are unavoidable I could dilute it because I could ask, is constitutional law a welcoming home for the cosmopolitan ideal? So that there might be more to the cosmopolitan ideal than what goes into constitutional law. And indeed, I think that's actually the case. So if you look at research that's been done on international law and the way that we haven't talked here about, for example, human rights treaties and the kind of impact, the radiating effect that these supranational legal instruments have on the shaping of constitutional law is a very significant impact. How does the cosmopolitan ideal shape some of that? And there are some people who are working on this question, specifically in the European context, people like Matthias Kuhn, sort of an integrated conception of public law. What I think is missing from this account is the focus on the internal structure of the state, and specifically the connection between the internal structure of states that have republican constitution in this sense and the larger project of global constitutionalism. This is an account of global constitutionalism, but it is also an account of comparative constitutional law, and this goes back to the idea of colonialism and imperialism. What this project is incomplete, I mean, it's forever incomplete, but it's awfully incomplete without an account of the role and importance of difference, institutional difference, institutional imagination, the space that each community has to decide the terms of its own self-government. And that is what, in my view, comparative law provides. So what I'm working on now is an account of what's the role of comparative law in global constitutionalism. Because that's the only argument that can properly answer how the colonial impulse can be held in check, because I think it's there and I think it's part of us, but how it can be held in check, and for that I think you need comparative law, but in a way that comparative lawyers are not very helpful. So you have to reimagine the field of comparative law, because there just is not much in comparative law as it was done in the 20th century that can help with this.
We just to follow up, just to
sure, we've got to wrap up. Yeah.
Sure. I think that's an excellent move in that project, and you might want to look for parallels within the international trade law,
mm-hmm.
because the same conversation is happening around policy space for developing countries in the face of universalist principles within the WTO framework.
Mm-hmm.
So how to create a structure that accommodates that kind of room and how that changes the
yeah.
structure is very much
important. That's very helpful. That's, yeah.
Great.
That's
well, thank you so much
all
for
right.
being
thank
here.
Thank you so
thank
much.
You all.